From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula. Hello, and welcome to Korean Context. I'm your host, Jenna Gibson, Director of Communications here at KEI. On January 13, 1903, the first Korean immigrants arrived in the United States. KEI celebrates the occasion by honoring several Korean Americans who have excelled in their field. And this year, we are honoring three leaders in culinary excellence, including today's guest, Chef Edward Lee. Chef Lee is the chef owner of 610 Magnolia in Louisville, Kentucky, and he has also recently opened a restaurant called Succotash here in the D.C. area. Originally from Brooklyn, New York, he got his degree from NYU in English literature and then decided to pursue the culinary arts instead. Chef Lee has been a finalist for the prestigious James Beard Award and was on Iron Chef America and Top Chef, hosted season 3 of The Mind of a Chef on PBS, and has been doing a lot of other projects as well that we're excited to talk to him about. So Chef Lee, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So let's start from the beginning. Where did your love of food come from, and how did you make this switch from English literature to cooking?
I don't know specifically where it came from. I've just always loved food, which is interesting because my sister doesn't, and neither of my parents really, they like it, but it's not like a passion for them. The earliest thing I can remember is my grandmother was always in the kitchen. She lived with us, and so she always made, she made gochujang from scratch, and she made her own miso, and she made her own kimchi, and she was always pickling stuff. And so I learned from her, I think, more than anything, the appreciation of food, and that it takes a long time to make something good, that you don't just go to the store and buy a sauce. Like, you make it from scratch. So I think I got that quality from her. But otherwise, from the earliest memory, I have always loved food, and more so than that, I just loved going to restaurants. We didn't go out to eat a lot. We didn't have a lot of money, so going out to eat was a treat. And I can honestly say that was more exciting to me than going to a movie or going to the park or what sporting events. Like, to me, going to a restaurant was like this incredible, insane treat. So it's just always been in my DNA.
Was it difficult for you to make that switch from literature to...
No, it was actually very easy because I actually didn't want to go to college. I went to college because, again, as Korean immigrants, it was very important for me to graduate college. I was the first person to graduate from an American university, right? Because my sister didn't, so... And especially, I'm their only son, and so there was a lot of pressure that I graduate college. My passion was I wanted to go straight to cooking school, from high school, but I kind of did it for them. So actually the transition was really easy because once I kind of got my degree and I was like, all right, I'm done with that. And then, which is also why I got a literature degree, because I just knew that whatever I learned in college, that wasn't going to be my career, which kind of helped me out because now I do a lot of writing, but I pursued as a major just what I really loved, which was literature and reading. There were other kids in college that were stressing about their major and law or pre-med or communication. And I just always knew, I said, as soon as I graduate college, I'm going to cook for a living. So I can just, I really enjoyed college because everyone was stressing about stuff. And I just spent 4 years reading wonderful books and just lounging around in the library. As soon as I graduated college, I kind of, I did try and get a few jobs in sort of the, putting a suit and tie on and going to work. And it just never worked out for me. So after 2 years of that, I decided I was just going to pursue cooking full time.
So from when you started pursuing cooking and up until now, how would you say that your Korean-American background has influenced your food?
Hugely so. I think when you're younger, you are more concerned about impressing other people, right? Other chefs and certainly your bosses. And so as a young chef, I wasn't cooking the food I wanted to. I was either cooking someone else's food or I was cooking to impress or what I thought other people wanted me to cook. So obviously I was doing a lot of French food, a lot of Eurocentric stuff. And, you know, I got to sort of, I guess, in my early 30s, you know, you start to mature and you start to kind of, you start to unravel your own identity. And once you start to do that, obviously, you know, all the things about what my grandmother used to make and what we used to eat as a kid sort of came back to me. I think one of the things that really struck me was you spend so many years going to, and I never went to a full cooking school, but you spend so many years learning techniques. And so I spent many years rejecting the stuff that my grandmother was doing. Because to me, as a young professional chef, right, wearing a chef coat and all that and working in French kitchens, well, the stuff my grandmother did couldn't be important because it's not part of this culinary tradition. You get to a certain level of maturity and you step back and you realize that, no, the stuff that she was doing actually was really important and it does have a culinary history and it actually does matter. And so once you start to merge all of the training that you've done, you know, in these very strict sort of French kitchens, and you start to merge that with the stuff that you remembered as a kid, I think you begin to sort of create a cuisine that's very unique to you. And so to me, you know, I guess for the past 10 years or so, that's what I've been doing is to try and create not Korean food, not Southern food, not French food, but just my food. And my food is, you know, a combination of all that.
So you had this kind of career change, if you could call it that, but you also had a location change at a certain point. You, as I mentioned, you grew up in New York, but then you moved and established yourself in Louisville. So how did that happen?
Is a lot of serendipity and you know, times changing. To be honest, you know, 9/11 was a large factor in that. I had a restaurant in downtown New York, and after 9/11, obviously, it's just we lost almost everything. And I, for a lot of people who didn't grow up in New York, I think 9/11 was a tragedy, you know, of great scale. But it was more of a, you know, it's a story. But I think for people, and I know like friends of mine too, you know, who in New York City is my hometown, for lack of a better word. It's like, you know, imagine if you grew up in a small town in Ohio and someone bombed it, you know, like it would be really life-changing. And so in that way, it was more than just a tragedy. I mean, it really kind of shook me up. And I felt it, in some ways it was like some weird ending of a chapter, you know, like New York was changing, I was changing, you know, the world was changing, and my career was changing. I had been 5 years at this restaurant that I was cooking at, and I was just tired of it, and I didn't want to do it anymore, and I felt all these signs, and, you know, I had a girlfriend at the time who left me, you know, it's all these things kind of coming together, and I thought, you know, maybe this is just one more sign that says I should figure out what the next chapter of my life is going to be. I didn't think it was going to be the South. But I took a trip to Louisville. I went to the Kentucky Derby, and it like hit me instantly. And it's a funny sensation when you go to a place that you've never been to before, and you get there, and it feels like you've been there before, you know, or it feels like home. And I'm like, this is weird because I've never been here before. Maybe in a past life, I don't know. But, you know, I just came in and I just felt like this is some place I could really hang out for a while. And I wasn't planning on it. I came there and I came to the room and I became friends with the gentleman who eventually sold me the restaurant, 610 Magnolia. And I said, you know, I said, I need a change. I said, I'll stay for 6 months, maybe a year, just clear my head and eat great Southern food and drink bourbon and hang out and get it all out of my system and go back to New York. And that was 12 years ago. It's still not out of my system. So,
great. So I also really want to ask you about the restaurant here in D.C. because I know a lot of us here in the office have certainly been wanting to try it. So what's the story behind Succotash?
Well, we obviously, you know, Louisville's a small city and I have two restaurants there. And we just thought, at some point that we wanted to do something in another market, a bigger market, you know. And we started looking around and you thought, you know, New York is a little too big. I don't like Chicago. You know, Miami's too hot. So we just started looking around and I had some friends that I met many, many years ago who I knew were in the restaurant business. And they contacted me and they said, you know, we're thinking about opening a restaurant in the D.C. area. And which is really funny because I literally had been thinking about, well, DC is kind of a place that I could go to, but I don't know anyone there. Like, I can't just go and open a restaurant. And I was kind of like, I was talking to my wife and I said, you know, I could probably open a restaurant in DC. It would do well, but I don't know anyone. And literally, like, 2 weeks later, he called me and he was like, you know, Jason, who's my partner there, he said, yeah, we're thinking about opening a restaurant in D.C. I was like, this is so weird. And a lot of these things happen like that in the restaurant business. And it's just a lot of serendipity. So we started talking about it. We came up here. And anyway, he had found a location in Maryland, which is National Harbor. And I knew nothing. I was like, this place is like in the middle of nowhere. What is this? But we looked at the business model and thought, you know what? This is a great way to open a restaurant and feel out the market without being like in the center of DC. And we hope to open a restaurant in DC proper one of these days. We opened in September of 2015, and it's been nothing but busy since. I mean, literally from day one, it has been slammed. So you just never know. And so we did this partnership, you know, just to feel out the waters and see. But we had no idea how, I mean, I was just there for lunch and we just got slammed for lunch. I probably smell like catfish. Anyway, things are going really well and we're enjoying it. And I love being here. It's a great city.
Yeah, it's got, like you mentioned, it's not New York, but it's, you know, a little bit bigger. It's got a little bit of the Southern style.
What I like about it is that there are many, many people who live in D.C. have ties or are from the South. You know, I mean, Richmond, Virginia is not that far away, and that's a very southern city. So I think you have an appreciation of southern food here that you don't necessarily have in more northern cities like New York, Boston, Chicago, where to the majority of New Yorkers, southern food is still kind of a, I don't want to say a gimmick, but it's very stereotypical. Where I think in D.C., people understand southern food on a deeper level, that you don't have to do all the typical foods. You know, you can be playful with it. So they understand Southern food, but they're also, because we're not in the Deep South, I don't think you're held to the fire on tradition. So you don't have to plate the most traditional, you know, food. If I did succotash in Alabama, yeah, I'd probably get some people mad at me because I'm not doing traditional, you know, cornbread or traditional catfish fry. But I think in D.C. you can do that and be playful with it. And as a chef, personally, I've never been a purist or a traditionalist. You know, like if I cook French food, I don't cook pure French food. It's the same thing. I don't cook pure Korean food. There are great Korean chefs and great Korean restaurants. I am not one of them. But I do like to, I'm very experimental and progressive and playful with the food that I do. And I take the best of all the cuisines that I love and kind of put them together and come up with something new.
So on that topic, because during the discussion at our Korean American Day celebration, one topic that came up was the term fusion. And I know that you have some thoughts about this. So I'm curious, you know, to get your opinion, but Chef Rachel Yang, who is one of our other honorees, really has said that at first she pushed against it, and now she's really embraced this term fusion. Yeah. So what are your thoughts?
I could talk forever on this, but to me, fusion is a misinterpreted word. I think in just from a historical standpoint, and people like Norman Van Aken, who really coined the term to begin with, what was not about marrying cultural differences in food. It was more about marrying high and low culture. So it wasn't like two opposite cultures coming together. It was, you know, it was like bringing French technique to a very humble sort of tradition, like making ceviche, for example, which is something that every Latino does, you know, and it's a very almost a lowbrow kind of technique, but then, you know, putting it with a high, you know, French training. So to me, that is the actual origin of the word fusion. The way it's misinterpreted and the way we talk about it in these days is right, taking two disparate cultures and putting them together on a plate, which I don't quite understand that, because if we're talking about that as being the definition of fusion, then everything we do is fusion. So if you are in agreement and want to say that this is fusion food, then you're implying that there's something called authentic traditional food. And then that's when it becomes problematic to me, right? Because what's traditional? What's traditional Italian food? You can go to a traditional Tuscan restaurant in D.C., and I can guarantee you someone from Italy is going to come in there and go, this is not Italian food, right? So what does tradition mean? And I think when we start discussing it in that terms, I think it's a dangerous way to go, and it's a dangerous way to explain food, because then it's a very slippery slope as saying, well, this is traditional, and then you say, well, this is correct, and this is the right way to do it. And once you start talking about that, then you have this, you know, really sort of, tyrannical view about food. And that's not the spirit of food. That's not the spirit of all the chefs that I know, you know, all the great people that I know that love food. A good friend of mine is a Thai chef. It's very interesting because everyone will complain or talk to him about, well, what's traditional Thai food? And what's, you know, this is traditional Thai food. That's not. And he'll say, well, you know, you go to Thailand, what's traditional Thai food? Thai food is a fusion of Southeast Asian cuisine, of Chinese cuisine, of Indian spices, of you know, so many things go into making Thai food. That by its very definition is a fusion of many different cultures. And so you can't at that point say, well, what's traditional Thai food, you know? I mean, what year did the Chinese invade and come over? And, you know, I mean, and then you talk about American history. It's like, really, what's traditional Chinese food in America? The definition is constantly changing. So, you know, my thing is we don't cook fusion food. We cook American food. And if you think you're an Italian chef because you make pasta, then you're misinterpreting the whole thing. We all are reinterpreting things through an American lens. I can want to be a Korean chef all I want. I can't. I was born in Brooklyn. You know, I grew up watching The Simpsons. You know, it's I'm an American chef. Whether now I can be an American chef that interprets Korean ingredients in a certain way to make a personal vision of food, but I'm not. The only Korean chefs are the ones that live in Korea. So all of us of what we do here are just figuring out ways to put our American stamp on all these different ethnic cuisines that sort of migrate into this country. And that, I think, is something to be celebrated, and that's beautiful. Because through that, we get these really creative explorations into cuisine. And it's a conversation that you can't have in Korea, right? Because it's too traditional. You know, it's like bibimbap is bibimbap, and there may be, you know, 40 different variations of it, but it's just generally one way, you know. And here, we don't have to do that because we're not bound by the same traditions and the same heritage and the same grandmas looking over our shoulder. So we can be much more playful here. And so I take advantage of that, and I try and be as playful as I can.
As I mentioned earlier at the top, you've had a great deal of television exposure, shows like Top Chef, Finest Chef America, Mind of a Chef. What were some of the professional challenges and opportunities that came from having that wider national audience?
Obviously, it brings exposure and people come to the restaurants. I think that from a business standpoint, it's great because your restaurants get busy. I think the biggest challenge is the misperceptions, I think. It's very weird to be on TV and have people kind of assume some things about you because they see you on TV. And so they come to the restaurant having somewhat of a preconceived notion about what they're going to get or what they're going to experience because of some conclusion they made while they were watching you on TV. And some of it's good, some of it's not. And some of it's really unexpected or it's unrealistic. Or people come into, you know, 610 Magnolia is a very high-end restaurant and it's very precious and the food is very small and it's, you know, very, very weird flavors. And some people wander in because they've seen me do something on TV expecting, you know, a steak and a Caesar salad. And it's not as though they dislike the meal. It just wasn't what they were thinking they were going to get. And so that's the biggest challenge of it is sort of guiding expectations of customers who come in. You know, before I did TV, people came to the restaurant and they didn't know what to expect. So they were just curious and they would sit down and we would give them the experience and they would be, you know, some would like it, some would not. But overall, people would be very, you know, pleasantly surprised. The difference now is people come into the restaurant already knowing that, hey, you better impress me, you know, and so it's a different set of expectations. And so we have to be even better, you know, we can't just be good enough. So we are constantly pushing ourselves because we know the expectation is higher. And that's a hard thing to live up to, because there's some people who have just high, really high expectations. And so people say, oh, it must be easy now that you're famous. And actually it's really much, much harder, because now there's no end to the sort of criticisms that come. So we always feel like we're, you know, under the gun, and we have to constantly push to get better.
So for most of our listeners, they probably know this, but KEI's mission is to foster understanding and friendship between the United States and Korea. And Korean American Day has always been about honoring Korean Americans who do that and who have helped bridge these two cultures through their work. So how do you see food as a cultural bridge?
Oh, I mean, gosh, it's I think the greater purpose of food is always about bridging people together. I can sit at a dinner and have the best meal of my life, but if I'm eating by myself, it doesn't feel the same. And I think the purpose of restaurants, which sometimes gets lost in this very Instagram-centric world, and I hate to say this because I'm a chef, but it's not about the food. It's about the gathering. It's about the social experience of being together. You know, ever since I was a little kid, the fascination I've had with restaurants is not, yes, it's food, obviously, but it's like, you know, like 40, 50, 60 random people all in this room together with the same common goal, right, to eat. You know, and you can meet people, and you can, you know, run into people you might know, or you can make friends with your wait staff. And there's something magical about that. And I think in a time where we've seen, you know, everything has gone online, right? So you can watch your movies online. You can get your music. And there's no record stores anymore. There's no bookstores anymore. There's no movie theaters anymore. I mean, everything is online. Luckily, you can't get your food online. And so we still need restaurants. And I think more so than ever in history in this country, restaurants are a magnet for social gathering, to just get a pulse of the city. You know, like when you go to a city that you don't know or haven't been to, the first thing I do is go to a restaurant or a bar, and I get a feel for the city, and I start asking the bartenders, and like, where should I go? What should I do? I mean, that, think about it, restaurants are now like the cultural centers of cities. I think human beings are still communal, and we want to be together, and we want to meet strangers, and we want to feel like there's community. There's nothing, you know, there's nothing to do anymore where we feel like we can be together. And so you build a restaurant and you make it warm and inviting, and people start to come, and this magical thing happens. Like sometimes I just sit at the restaurant and I just watch people make friends with each other at my restaurants. And that, to me, that is the most magical thing, is to watch two strangers come in and become friendly at the end of the night. That's what we do. You know, we create these spaces for people to come and gather and socialize. And that's what being, to me, that's what being human is. You know, we need to eat. Eating is really just an excuse to, like, you know, hang out with other people. So if we can do it on a global scale, that's great. You know, I go to Korea at least once a year. And usually we're there cooking dinner for one group or another. And it's fascinating to see how people react to my food. It's fascinating that things that are really, I can make the leap in my head really quickly. Like, oh, let's take gochujang and put it with butter and then add lime juice and then add honey and do this to them. And then Korean people are like, wow, that's mind blowing. You know, because they're live in a much more strict sort of culinary world. But then there are other things that they do that's so traditional that I could never do. There's a place that I go to in Korea, and they make pimeong naengmyeon. It's like this historic place, and they've been making it the same way for like 40 years. And it's the same stock. It's the same. And there's something beautiful about, I could never do it, you know, because I'm too scatterbrained. But like, there's something beautiful about making that exact same dish again and again and again. You do something for 40 years, you're going to reach a level of perfection. It's almost like some nirvana of noodles, right? Because it's just, you go there And I go there almost every time in Korea. You just, you sense the flavor. It's just so different, you know. You can sense the history of the flavor. So things like that are just, to me, they transcend food or nutrition or anything. To me, that these are like magical moments. And you know, every time I go to Korea, I meet new friends. And it's usually over a meal because, you know, I eat a lot. To me, the power of food is still something that, and more so in this modern world, I think it's a magical thing.
I think that's a really great note to end this on. Okay. So, Chef Lee, thank you very much for coming, and thank you for being one of our Korean American Day honorees.
Thank you very much.
That's all for this episode of Korean Context. Please remember to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts. We hope you enjoyed this episode and that we'll see you again next week.